I think we'll start. Welcome to. Yeah, ready? Welcome to week two of the Little Things That Change Your Life series based on the book Make Your Bed. Before we start, just two quick announcements. Again, the same thing as last week. I want to remind everyone, a week from tomorrow night, on the 23rd, we've got the Mindful Minyan, followed by a Mindful Meal with a theme of Purim this time. If you can't come to the meal, you can still come to the Minyan. So, but if you do want to come to the meal, if you could book, so we can be organized. Also, don't forget that 2 weeks from today, it's a Thursday, we'll have our regular session, but it's Purim, so we always do a little bit extra with a bit of a morning tea. We'll also have, for those that want, at 8:30, a Megillah reading before the Shiur, and then the session that we'll do will be the regular time, but we'll connect it with Purim, as always. Okay, so we're busy working through the book Make Your Bed, by William McRaven, a distinguished Navy SEAL, where he shares the lessons that he learned during his Navy training, which become 10 lessons, really important life lessons. So just a little bit of review from last week. Last week, we shared with what he writes in his first chapter about starting each morning with making his own bed, making it well. He described the inspection that used to happen every single day, and that was his first discipline, his first structure of the day, all throughout his training, all throughout his career, really. And just very briefly, last week we talked about four lessons that we can learn from that concept. The first was the idea of discipline. We talked about Kabbalat Ol, the idea of being subservient and sometimes surrendering to things that are difficult for us, perhaps don't talk to us, perhaps are meaningless. And yet it's that value of discipline that we appreciate that we are limited, and therefore sometimes we need to go beyond ourselves by entertaining things that are difficult for us at the moment, but perhaps at a later stage it will gel with us. That's an important part of our life experience, and a very Jewish idea rooted all the way back to the giving of the Torah, where the Jews said Na'aseh v'nishma. Nishma means we'll understand, and they were committed to understanding, and understanding and engaging is so important. But yet they began with a foundational na'aseh, which is we're going to submit and we're going to connect even if it doesn't quite fit with our understanding. The second was the value of structure, how structure creates a focus, structure is beneficial, and all the other benefits that we talked about. The third lesson we talked about was whatever you do, do it well. The idea, especially the connecting with the whole concept of mindfulness and living in the moment, and connecting with a fundamental Jewish concept that there is no means to an end, really, in value living, in Jewish living, because whatever we do has to have some value, and if it's got value, we need to be fully there. Even if we have aspirations for greater goals and greater expectations, which is all good, but at the moment where we are, where we're meant to be, what we're doing, if we worked it out that it fits with our values, is what we're meant to be doing, and therefore we need to put ourselves fully into it, and that's the concept of whatever we do, as meaningless as it might seem, as small as it might seem, we try to do it well. And the fourth lesson we talked about was breaking down tasks and starting the day right, meaning it might be small and sometimes we feel overwhelmed, but if we break down the things that we need to do into small little sections and we commit to doing some good things at the beginning of the day, we talked about the concept how the beginning of the day influences the rest of the day, we feel fulfilled. At best, success breeds success. At worst, the day wasn't meaningless. At least we got something accomplished. So those were the lessons that we learned from last week. Now today, we're going to move on to chapter 2 of the book, where he shares a different idea based on his experiences. And what I want to do is just read some excerpts of that chapter and then develop some ideas around the theme. So he writes the following. He says, I learned early on in SEAL training the value of teamwork, the need to rely on someone else to help you through the difficult tasks. For those of us who were tadpoles, hoping to become Navy frogmen, a 10-foot rubber raft was used to teach us this vital lesson. Now, how so? So he continues and explains like this. Everywhere we went during the first phase of SEAL training, we were required to carry this raft, right? So they walked around the whole day with this raft. We placed it on our heads as we ran from the barracks across the highway to the chow hall. We carried in a low slung position as we ran up and down the Coronado of sand dunes. We paddled the boat endlessly from north to south along the coastline and through the pounding surf. Seven men, all working together to get the rubber boat to its final destination. And then he continues with the lesson, and he says the following. But we learned something else on our journey with the raft. Occasionally, one of the boat crew members was sick or injured, unable to give it 100%. I often found myself exhausted from the training day or down with a cold or a flu. On those days, the other members picked up the slack. They paddled harder. They dug deeper. They gave me their rations for extra strength. And when the time came later in training, I returned the favor. It says, the small rubber boat made us realize, and this is the punchline, one of the punchlines, that no man could make it through training alone. No SEAL could make it through combat alone. And by extension, you needed people in your life to help you through the difficult times. Now in the chapter, he continues, if you want to read on your own, to talk about some experiences he had later when he was injured and he was in the middle of his career and he felt he wouldn't be able to be promoted further and people came to his aid, and just the support that he had from other people was just amazing how he was able to get back and continue his climbing on the rung of success, of the ladders of success. And at the end, he writes the following, and he says, none of us are immune from life's tragic moments. Like the small rubber boat we had in basic SEAL training, it takes a team of good people to get you to your destination in life. You cannot paddle the boat alone. Find someone to share your life with, make as many friends as possible, and never forget that your success depends on others. So that's the essential lesson. Now, simple but powerful, yeah. So this lesson exactly, simple but powerful, is so true on so many levels, right? And for so many reasons. And the reason for that is, there's different angles of this which we're going to try and explore, but the end result of all the layers, and in life for success and happiness, there's a few things we always have to remember to create this teamwork, right? First thing is we have to help and give. And the second is we need to learn when and how to reach out and take when we need, right? And thirdly, in order to do all of that, it doesn't come in a vacuum. We actually have to learn how to make connections with other people. Why? Because as we've said many, many times, the way God designed us from the very beginning, written into the very beginning of Genesis, is that we cannot be alone or lonely or do it alone. Right? We need others. We need other people. And what's interesting is, I just saw a very beautiful little clip lately, which I'm going to share with you. Connecting with others and the power of connecting with others, right? Is not only people who are close. Now, it is too, of course, close friendships, close people, close family, and those connections are vital and critical and so important. But actually, it's even about connecting to strangers. I'm not sure if we often think about that, how connected we are to the strangers that we come across during our routine daily, right? Let me just show you a very, very short video, it's not as long as last week's, about the power of connecting with strangers. Can I ask someone just to turn off the light? Yeah, can you just turn off the light? Oh, the light, yeah.
So what does it take to lift your mother again? As you will see, the answer is not what we expect. Julianne Holt Lunstead is a researcher at Brigham Young University, and she addressed this very question in a series of...
Okay. So I thought that was a... So I wanted just to show that with you because it expands the topic a bit, that when we talk about you cannot do it alone, it's not only you cannot do it alone, you need close people around you, which we do, but actually we need lots of people around us. And there's an effect in a group power, which we're going to explore a little bit, that is far beyond just our close circle. So let's explore some of the ideas behind this phenomenon. So first of all, something we've spoken about many, many times is that the way God designed the world is give and take, giving and receiving. We've talked about this many, many times. Because he wanted a world of chesed. He wanted a world of kindness, we are taught. The Talmud teaches us that. He wanted a world where we'd complement each other, where we'd give to each other. And it's about thinking into that concept and reflecting of how that actually works. Now, at the very end of the Chumash, just before Moses dies, he gathers the whole Jewish people together. And he says to them these words, he says, Atem nitzavim hayom kulchem. You are standing here all together as one. And he goes on to list 10 different groups. Your leaders, your heads, your tribes, your different people. Ending off up until the woodchoppers and the water carriers and so on and so forth. And that concept of being as one, there's a great Hasidic master, Rosh Nei Zalman of Ladi, in one of his books, explains the following idea. He says, we often slip into a mindset, a sort of a hierarchical mindset, right? Now, not that hierarchical mindsets don't exist, and for a society to function, there is some sort of hierarchical structure that is necessary. So, for example, you've got the leaders, you've got those that are more scholarly, those that have the ability to lead in ways that people below them sort of don't, right? Moses was a great leader of the Jewish people and so on and so forth. However, he makes two points, and this is such an important thing to bear in mind in terms of how we need others and how we cannot paddle alone. He says, first of all, even in a hierarchical structure, and his analogy is head and feet, the head can guide the body of where to go, but the head cannot go there without the feet. Right? Now, it's a simple idea, but the question is, how often do we actually really, really appreciate that? And to take it a little bit further, what happens in society is, what happens in a group is that, therefore, we are all heads. What that means is we all have something, skills, emotional abilities, cognitive skills, talents, abilities, time, whatever it is that others don't have. And therefore, as we've talked about many, many times, there is something that we can all give, and there's lots of things we all need to receive, because none of us have it all, and none of us can do it alone. And such an important thing to remember. So, this is a very simple analogy. A machine cannot work, will not work, will break down without the minutest screw. Right? A large business, as huge as it might be, won't function, will actually completely shut down if the person running the mail room is not doing a good job. A society cannot function without garbage collectors. Right? Now, why do I say that? Because, again, we all know that, right? But the question that we have to ask ourselves in terms of connections, going back to that little clip, do we connect with those people? Or do we just take them for granted? Do we drive out in my street it's a Wednesday morning, and just get angry that the garbage collector once again is blocking the street? And I know that for the last 10 years they've been doing it every single Wednesday morning, and I still didn't give myself an extra 5 minutes to get to shul in the morning, so I go the regular time, I get blocked in the street, and then I'm angry with the garbage collector, right? Which is pathetic. I mean, what would happen if they wouldn't come? What? Why do I expect them to get up 2 in the morning when I'm not getting up 2 in the morning? Right? So they got a job to do. They try their best. They do an amazing job, actually. So instead, what I should really be doing, and in recent years I've tried better, I suppose, is to actually take it easy or leave early. Or if you do get blocked, just sit tight, sit calm, and say good morning. And say thank you. Connect to the person. How's your day going? Not much, I mean, how's the beginning of the day going, I should say. Because they're doing something for me that, number one, I couldn't do. I mean, I could for 3 houses, but then probably I can't get. And they do something that is absolutely vital. Imagine if there was no, I mean, just as an example, right? So I think in society as general, in terms of connecting to people, it's about not only connecting to people, it's connecting to people like we just saw, about talking to them and making connections with them, and just generally the health and the benefit that comes with connecting to people. But it's also about appreciating people and appreciating the part that they do for the overall functioning of who we are that you cannot do. And it's making sure to express that, to say thank you to the postman when you see them. In our street, we've got a male lady actually that she's wonderful. Like she's doesn't only deliver mail; she actually knows everything about everyone. Right? She knows the whole. By now, she knows the whole life history: whose kids are coming, whose kids are married, when they have children. But it's actually beautiful. I'm not. She's not a Yentin anyway. She's just really an amazing person, and she's amazing to talk to. So it's about valuing people, as human beings, with their dignity, with understanding who they are, understanding what they give that we can't do, and just. But it's not just hierarchically like that. It's everything in life. There's so much that we can give and should give, and there's so much that we can take and do take, but not always appreciate it, or sometimes don't take because we don't know how to reach out. So that's just on a very simple level. The second lesson to remember is a saying that I've shared with you before, coming from the great sages, that Ein chavush atzmo matira b'meis asurim. A prisoner cannot let themselves out of prison. What that means is as follows. That means even if we have something that we normally can give, but it doesn't mean that we can give it to ourselves, and that's such an important thing to remember, right? We might be the strongest of the group. We might be leaders. We might be people who give advice to others. But when we're going through a challenging situation, when we end up in our own internal jail, in our own internal prison, whether that's because of external circumstances, like tragedy or sickness or whatever the challenge is, or it's an internal prison that we've created ourselves, it's our own emotional problem, or whatever the challenge might be, it might be the very thing that we can help others with plenty of times, but we'll not be able to help ourselves. And that's such a problem sometimes with people who like to be heroes and can never reach out to others. And it becomes a particular problem when they don't reach out to others because I know I can do this. And the proof I can do this is, we all say, because I've done it so many times. I've done it for so many people. So why can't I do it for myself? And the answer is you can't, because a prisoner cannot let themselves out of their own prison. You can unlock the prison door for someone else, but not for yourself. Now, in fact, this is true with everything. The way God designed life and the way our structure of life is established, there are even good things that we can't do ourselves. Happiness, for example, we can feel happy. But when I want to create a tremendous energy of happiness, it's something you can't do alone. That's why we have laws in the Torah, for example, things that are considered tremendous mitzvot, like making a bride and groom happy, like dancing at a wedding. Right? According to the Talmud, it's one of the greatest mitzvot. Everyone goes to a wedding and dances at a wedding. There's all these different rewards that happen, amazing stuff. Right? Why? Because it's their happy day. So it's their happy day. What has that got to do with me? Okay, I'm a friend of the bride and groom. That's nice. But it's much more than that. It's because it's their happy day. It's their experience where they need to feel happiness, where they need to be in an environment of an intense energy of happiness. And it cannot be done unless there's people around doing it for them. It would always be a happy occasion, but if someone, and there were stories like that throughout the wars and throughout challenging times, where people put up a chuppah and got married with 3.5 people, and yeah, they lived happily after, that's true, but there was lacking, they were missing. The day wasn't as happy. Why? Because you need people. In fact, the Talmud says it the opposite way around too. Warning people that when they go to a wedding, they have to get involved. It's a mitzvah. Why? Because you have to give. Because they need to take in this situation. It's not a bad taking, it's not a negative taking. It's a beautiful taking. It's a collective power. It's a thing which we do together, which is absolutely beautiful. Unfortunately, the same is true in the opposite. When a person goes through a tragedy or challenge, we have this tremendous system of comforting mourners, visiting sick, and all this, and so on and so forth, which is needs to be done in the proper way. We need to know how to give, but also people need to know how to take, as we've talked about many times. And people need to know how to reach out. Sometimes people go through traumas and problems and they don't reach out, and sometimes they don't reach out until it's too late. Because when crisis suddenly descends in a very, very big way and they reach out, sometimes it's so much damage and so much internal or emotional harm has been done that it's such a pity they haven't reached out till then. So people need to give, but people need to reach out. We need to know how to take. We need to know we cannot paddle alone. We need to know sometimes we just need the help of others. Even when it's cases where we can offer the very, very same help. So in other words, the first point is there's certain things we can never give other people because that's how society works. We each have different things we can contribute. But this point is that even when we have those things, those resources to give, but we can't give them to ourselves necessarily. And therefore, we just need to know when it's time to reach out to others and take and let others help us. And then, of course, in times where we can help, we return the favor, we return the closeness and the bond and the connection. We know that today, with these amazingly effective programs, the 12-step programs, which are designed for addiction, starting off with alcoholism, you know, the 12 steps alcoholic program, one of the critical themes around the program is the togetherness, the support group, the fact that people are supporting each other. It's interesting, you know, the Torah, we just read a few weeks ago in the weekly parsha that the Torah was given on Mount Sinai and so on. And the Torah makes a very, very big emphasis about the fact that the Torah was given in the third month. Why the third month? Because our rabbis tell us that the Torah was given to bring peace to the world, to bring people together. That's the essence of what Torah is, which is a separate discussion of why that is. But the Torah was given, the Torah and Shalom are very, very synonymous. And yet the commentaries point out that even though it's about oneness and peace and togetherness, it wasn't given in the first month. Because first month is not peace and togetherness. First month is one. One is alone. Two sometimes represents conflict, but three means a togetherness. That's the symbolism of those three numbers. And therefore the Torah was given in the third month specifically because of that concept, to show that people need each other. It was when the Jews camped at Mount Sinai in unison, in unity, that the Torah was able to be given, but there had to be all those people together because the collective power, the helping each other, the supporting each other. We find this in the story of Purim, which is 2 weeks away. One of the amazing stories of Purim is the moment in the Megillah, in the Purim story, where Mordechai, one of the heroes of the Purim story, finds out this decree, this terrible decree that's taken place to threaten the entire existence of the Jewish people. And he's donned sackcloth and he's praying, and Esther, who's the queen, finds out that something's happened, but she doesn't know what because she's in the palace. So she sends a message, and the message comes back to Esther about what had happened. And Mordechai says to Esther, and therefore the only one who can help is you, because you're close to the king. You need to go to the king to intercede on behalf of the Jewish people. At first, as the story goes, she resists because it was dangerous. She hadn't been called to the king for 30 days, as the story goes. Mordechai says, you there, it's your mission. You've got to do it. So she says, okay, but here's one condition. And this is the amazing verse. She says, Leich kenos et kol ha-yehudim. Go and gather the entire Jewish population of Shushan and let them fast and pray for 3 days, and only then I'll go. So the commentaries ask, what do you mean then you're going to go? It was urgent. Go now. So she says, I'm going to go. And by the way, the fast, for those who know the history, the fast wasn't around Purim time. When all this happened, it was Pesach time. And it was an amazing thing because there was a dialogue, according to the Medrash, that went between Mordechai and Esther about the Seder night. That year, the Jews didn't make a Seder because they were fasting. And Mordechai says to Esther, but there's a Seder on Seder night. So she says in her prophecy, in a prophetic vision, she says, if this doesn't work, there won't be a Seder forever. So it's okay. We need to suspend the Seder this year. And now a separate halachic discussion of how that can take place. But it happened. So why did it happen even though it was urgent? Because Esther knew that although she was the one who could do it, only her, because she was in the palace, she was close to Ahasuerus, and if someone could go and get Haman exposed, it would be her. But she also knew that she cannot do it alone. She also knew that she needs the spiritual support in that case, the moral support in that case as well, of the entire Jewish community in Shushan. So she said, I'm going to go and I'm confident I'll be successful, but not before I've got the entire community behind me. And they fasted for 3 days and she went and the mission was successful. So here again in Purim you see that idea. We need to know when we can't do things alone. Esther was the greatest. She was one of the seven prophetesses. She was an amazingly righteous woman. But she knew she couldn't do it alone. So that's the second idea. The third thing I wanted to cover is an interesting one. Just the collective power of many together. In Jewish thinking, despite the video we saw last week, 1 + 1 doesn't equal 2. Right? Imagine that. It doesn't equal 22 either, by the way. Right. 1 + 1 In people getting together, in numbers, yeah, it does equal two. We're not revising math, don't worry. Right? But 1 plus 1, we are taught, equals many, equals multiple times the individual power separately put together. Right? So we have, in Jewish thinking, many, many examples of this. One example is, for example, with the laws of prayer. We have the laws of a minyan. We need 10 men to be able to do certain parts of tefillah. But we are taught in many, many places that the idea of 10 men is not that you have 10 individuals. And we say you need 10. We had the other morning, we were having a shachrit, someone walked in, we were struggling a bit, some people were late and some people were away. You know, it goes and shuls, you know, do we have a minyan? Some guy walks, he says, come on, for small communities, can't we like change the law? Can't there be like a 7 thing or something? I said, unfortunately not, sorry, we're put down by the rules. But the power of 10 is not just 10 separate people coming together and 10 somehow is the magical number. It is a magical number, but what happens at 10, we are taught, is that a whole new thing is created. It's a new status. It's a new unit. It's called a minyan. It's not 10. A minyan is no longer 10 individual people. It's a force of a group that is way beyond the numbers that equal 10. Am I making sense? Is it?
Yeah.
There was a story of I don't remember which Hasidic Rebbe was, but there was a Hasidic Rebbe who called one of his followers and says, you know, I haven't seen you in shul lately. What's with davening? But tzibur, we call it, davening, you know, in a group. He says, Rabbi, I really am much better focused when I pray alone. I prefer to stay at home and I can think better, there's no distractions. It's much better. So it was winter apparently, and there was a fireplace just in the side of the room. So the rabbi walks over to the fireplace and he says, let me show you something. Takes a metal stick and he moves one of the coals, the burning bright coals in the fireplace, away from the rest of the coals. He says, what do you think? He says, well, it looks beautiful. It's burning brightly. He says, wait a half a minute. And as we wait half a minute, the whole thing calms down and the coal dies. He says, that's why it burns very brightly and the individuality is beautiful and individuality is important when you see it alone, when you see it separate, but it's so much more powerful when it's with other people. I just want to share with you a nice story because, you know, this is true in life generally. When we do things together, particularly when things can have challenges, when things are more difficult or even not so difficult, just complicated a bit or a little bit hard or difficult, when we do it together, it's so much more powerful. So just last week, there was in New York, there was a conference called Kinnus HaShluchot, which is the conference of Chabad Rebbetzins, essentially. So a few months ago, I shared with you stories. I was there by the rabbi's one. This is the Rebbetzin's one. My daughter-in-law was there, so I watched a couple of clips online. So the MC of the major banquet that they have at the end, 3,000 people, was a Shlucha Rebbetzin in some, I can't even pronounce the name of the town, but it's a town in China. Now, there are a couple of Shluchot and Shluchim in China, Beijing and other places. Essentially, they're there for expats and people who come there on business and things like that. They do an amazing job. But you can imagine, it's challenging, right? And she's telling a story of when she first came to this Kwantung or something it's called, came to this town. There were no Jews in the town whatsoever, but they knew there would be a community there because there was an Israeli, in fact, there was a new Israeli branch of the Israeli ambassador's office that knocked on their door one day. They just opened up an office. So she looked at him and said, why'd you open up an office here? There's not many Jews yet. He says, what are you kidding? He says, if Chabad put a rabbi there, I know there's going to be a community. I'm not that stupid, right? So anyway, that's not the story I want to share with you. So she says, so I don't know if you know how it works in China. It's very difficult there because actually Judaism is not one of the recognized religions. It's an illegal religion. But yeah, it's an illegal religion in China. It's a communist place. China's, a, you know, we think it's, I mean, there's a bit of capitalism there, but it's actually a tough place. It's a communism place, a communist government. There's only 5 accepted religions, and Judaism is not one of them. However, you can run a center if it's not for Chinese, if it's only for expats and tourists and things like that, right? And they watch you closely. I know from the Shluchai in Beijing, this is it's like a big problem. So one day, there's a knock at the door, and it's the police. Because because very, very quickly, people got to know about them, and all these expats and tourists and people, business people following through started coming to the, I mean, they're having these big Shabbos tables, 70 people every Shabbos, and it's very, very beautiful. So police, in their broken English, basically tell them they've got to follow them to the police station. And they come and they're very nervous, you can imagine, sitting down there like they don't know what's going to be. And they start interrogating him and asking him questions. What are you doing here? Why did you come here? Why do you have so much activity in your house? And anyway, they're trying to explain. After a while, the questioner, the police questioner, pulls out a picture of the Lubavitcher Rebbe and says, "Who's this? Because you have so many pictures of this in your house. Like, who is this?" So the guy didn't know what to say. So he figured, how am I going to explain this? To, you know, they're part of a mission. And he was actually the founder of this mission to send people over the world and so on. So he tries to make it brief. So he says to the guy, he says, "Well, that's like our father. So we just want to think about him often. We love him. So we have a few pictures of him at home." So the guy nods and he says, "Ah, I see. So does that mean the rabbi in Beijing is your brother?" And she said, so obviously that had, so she said that was one of the most powerful moments in her whole shlichut, where she suddenly realized she's not alone. Which, by the way, is one of the whole benefits of this conference, that people come from all over the world and they realize, they get the inspiration just by being with the group, just by realizing that they're part of such a big, they're part of a bigger thing, right? You know, I have a brother-in-law who lives in Ashland, Oregon. Ever heard of it? Yeah, it's like a real, you would have. It's a real Shakespearean alternative, I don't know how you describe it. You know, like if you use a plastic plate in the town, like you're in big trouble, you know what I'm saying? Like a disposal, that kind of thing. And it can be very lonely, but he doesn't feel lonely. Like I've talked to him often about it, because this is what gives inspiration. When you know you're part of a group, when you know lots of people are doing the same thing, and it's true on all levels of life. It's true that when we reach out to other people, you know what's amazing? I'm sure you'll hear some people, where people suddenly go through a challenge, and if they do the right thing and they start reaching out, and unfortunately they realize that so many people are also going through the same challenge they didn't know about, because challenges normally are kept private, often, at least, and they suddenly realize, no, I'm not alone. I'm not the only one in the world going through this. Or it can be as simple as coming into a shul, and I've had this experience where people are very uncomfortable because they don't know the place, and they kind of convinced that everyone else in the shul knows how to daven, and they're the only guy that's walked in that doesn't know what's going on. Until you tell them, no, 95% of the people don't know what's going on, and it's fine. And suddenly they feel better, right? But hopefully. But it's not, I'm giving you simple, you know, silly examples, but it's true in every area of life. The power of being together, the power of a group, the power of not being alone is 1 + 1 = many. It's a very, very powerful energy. In the Chumash, you know, we have a story. There's two stories that are talked about in the weekly parasha of Noach. One is more famous than the other. The one is the flood, right? The Dor HaMabul, the flood. The people who were corrupt and God decided to bring human civilization to an end, kept 9 people alive, Noach, his 3 sons, and all the spouses. And from there, the human civilization started again. Why did he kill them? Because there was terrible corruption going on. Moral corruption, sexual corruption, thievery, robbery, and so on and so forth. However, interestingly enough, the pasuk, the verse says that the straw that hit the camel's, that broke the camel's back, the real reason with all the immorality that was going on was the division, the disunity that was among people. The fact that everyone was killing each other, stealing from each other, that was to God the most important problem. How do we see this even more emphasized later on in the parasha? Where you find another problem, which is not so well known. It's only a very few cryptic verses. It's called the Dor HaFlaga. It was a group of people also, a very, very big group of people, who decided, and that was sort of most of the civilization at the time, the world wasn't that big at the time, they decided to build a tower to fight God. Right? Now, that's a discussion in its own right, exactly what they were trying to do. In fact, it turns out they were very sophisticated people, they had a whole scientific theory. Essentially, what they did was a complete denial of God's existence and God's oneness and God's unity. Now, in the Torah, that's equally as terrible as immorality. Monotheism is the fabric of Judaism, belief in one God. And yet they weren't killed and they weren't punished that way. They had some sort of a punishment. God foiled their plan. The Chumash says he dispersed them. He changed the languages so they stopped understanding each other so well, and so on and so forth. But he didn't punish them in the same way as the flood generation. Even though on a spiritual level, they seem to be worse. Why? The commentaries explain, the Talmud explains, because one thing they had going for them, as negative as it was, they were together. They were united. And because they were united, because they were working together, God didn't allow them to perish. He allowed them to... He punished them, but it wasn't the same way. Whereas when it came to the flood, the members of the generation of the flood actually believed in God. Yet they were just indulgent people and very, very spoiled people, and they were evil people. They did the wrong thing. But part of their doing the wrong thing is they didn't work together. They weren't one. They were against each other, and therefore the mercy and compassion of God was much, much more limited, because the power of being together, even when it's negative, is just amazing. However, having said this, this concept is not always so easy. Right? It's often easier to be alone. And the reason for that is because being together means we have to manage differences and we have to manage ego. And that's another reason why sometimes people don't work as a team on any level of life experience. Teamwork is a fantastic thing. So much more gets done. So many more ideas come into the pot. Such diversity, such expansion. That's one of the reasons why being together is so powerful. It's a support emotionally, but it's also support creatively, right? And yet sometimes it doesn't happen because differences get in the way. And instead of people learning from differences and being inspired by differences, they clash with their differences. Why? Because as we've spoken about so many times, one of the greatest and hardest things to manage is our own ego. We feel threatened. We feel threatened that there's not enough to go around. There's not enough honor. There's not enough glory. There's not enough resource to go around. And therefore, we protect ourselves. That's why being together and reaching out and being part of a team and getting people to support us or bringing people for more ideas on whatever level of existence it is sometimes difficult. There's a story I read of a Hasidic rabbi called Reb Meir Premishlan. A congregant came to him and complained bitterly that someone had opened up a competition store across the road from him. I don't know, he was selling fruit and vegetables, whatever he was selling. He was a retailer, and someone had opened a bit close to him, opened up a competition store. So the Rebbe told him like this. He said, I want to ask you something. Have you ever watched a horse drink from a stream? He says, and? Where are you going with this? He says, you ever noticed that, apparently, that the horse taps with its hoof while it's drinking? He says, no, I didn't notice that, but I'll take your word for it. He says, you know why? He says, I'll tell you why. What happens is, the horse looks into the horse is drinking from the water, and therefore it sees its reflection, and he sees another horse also drinking from its water. And the horse is really afraid that it's all going to dry up, and it wasn't Cape Town. All right? The horse is afraid that there's not enough water in the river for both of them. So the horse starts to tap to scare the other horse away. And then realize that the horse is doing the same thing, obviously. Right? He says, believe me, he says, there's enough in the world. God is very resourceful. He's got enough for both of you. And the story goes that this particular follower took the Rebbe's words to heart and he changed it all around and instead met up with a guy and advised him and gave him tips. And they both flourished. Right? If I'm not mistaken, I'm not well-versed in business strategy, but apparently that's the theory around shopping centers where they put similar stores all together, because when the market's busy, everyone gains. Because the power of togetherness. Right? Now, I mean, obviously is a time where you're not supposed to affect other... I mean, there's a mitzvah in the Torah about not opening up a business in such a way where it undermines the other person and takes away their livelihood. But within reason, it becomes beneficial rather than detrimental. Right? Now, to understand the truth of all this, right, and understanding that underlying and sometimes subconsciously, it's actually difficult to be together. It's difficult to reach out to other people. Even for we going through struggle, sometimes we reach out to other people and we reach out to close people and they give us advice that we don't want to take on board. Now, we don't have to take everything people tell us on board, but sometimes it's people who tell us hard truths which we don't want to take, which we don't want to receive. Ego is a very, very interfering concept, right? Which prevents us from being together. And therefore what we need to do is, we need to understand that in order to achieve this concept of learning the power of a group, learning the truth that we cannot paddle alone, learning to reach out and to give, we actually have to create, before the challenge and before the necessity, we actually have to create a culture of connectivity. We have to create a culture of people being together. Because we also know, and this is now scientifically researched, that a culture of giving and a culture of togetherness brings happiness. Right? We know that. Happiness comes from giving rather than taking. Happiness comes from people being connected to each other. One of the laws of the Chagim, where there's a mitzvah in the Torah, v'samachta b'chagecha, you shall be happy in the festivals. One of the mitzvot is that there's a mitzvah to invite guests. Why? Because, and to take care of the poor, and to make sure that when it comes to the festival, those who have less are taken care of, and so on and so forth. Why is the Rambam puts it? Because there cannot be true joy unless there's a culture of giving. And a culture of giving, as we said many times, requires a healthy culture of being able to receive as well. It requires those that need to reach out, and it requires those that can give to give. And it's that culture of connection that creates this process of team, of group power. There's a story of Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berditchev, you heard me quote him many, many times, that he saw a man who was hurrying, running through the marketplace. And he stops him and he says, excuse me, sir, but do you mind if I ask you a quick question? He says, I'm in a hurry. He says, but I need to ask you just for a moment. He says, where are you running to? The guy says, I'm sorry, sir, I can't stop now. I'm in pursuit of my happiness. So Rabbi Levi Yitzchak says to him, how do you know your happiness is in the direction you're running? Maybe it's the other way. Like, how do you know where you're running? How are you running and find it? And what Rabbi Levi Yitzchak meant by that is that a happiness, as we said many, many times, does not come from things outside of us. It doesn't come from running away, running to things, running to get things. Happiness comes from within. If we can learn to manage difference, and we can learn to manage ego, and we can create a culture of giving, of connecting on all levels, small and big, whether it's helping people that need to be helped, whether it's giving away of our time, whether it's giving away of our resources. And we can also learn to facilitate that giving, as we spoke about a number of months ago, by making ourselves available to take when we need, or reaching out to people so they can offer support, not to retreat, so that no one even knows that we need help. If we can do that, we create a deep culture. We create a power of a team, a power of a group, and we create a culture and a society of happiness as well, with tremendous power and tremendous expansion and tremendous creativity. So how do we do this? In summary, we do this by creating a culture of giving, both big and small. And it goes back to things like saying hello, or stopping for 2 minutes and having a conversation with the garbage collector, with the mailman, with the person we see in the street, with the person we see in the lift. You know, you go into a lift and you're going to be there like for a minute. You sort of look away because, like, you're just not in the mood of talking to anyone today. But actually, it's an opportunity. You see a complete stranger, say hello, how's your day? Right? You go on a taxi, an Uber, strike a conversation, you find many, many things. The last Uber I went in, I ended up putting on tefillin with the guy because he was I saw his name. It wasn't the regular, you know, Muhammad and stuff like that. So, actually, I must say, it wasn't me. It was him. He says, "Nu, you ready for?" I get into the car. He's this happy-go-lucky guy. He says, "Nu, you ready for Shabbos?" I said, "Oh, this is going to be interesting." So I struck up a whole conversation. We knew common people. You know, yeah, it goes the Jewish geography, the whole thing. And he had a back problem, saying, I took his number, I called him up a few days later, I'm still planning to have for Shabbos, maybe we'll have a whole friendship out of this, right? But it's an amazing thing, you know, but you strike conversations with people in the lip, but it doesn't have to lead to anything. Just about connecting to a stranger, it's a beautiful thing. Politeness, it's nice, it's connection. But also a culture of giving in a big way, to really give when it's hard, to give when it is difficult. To train ourselves to be givers and to train ourselves at the same time to help and connecting to other people's struggles and connecting to other people in their capacity of giving when we need to reach out. And also means connecting to people. There are concepts we get taught in Jewish culture, in Jewish literature, about learning the art of connection. You see, connection doesn't just mean a casual conversation. It does mean with strangers. When it comes to people more close, it means really connecting to people on a deeper level. There's this concept of hanoseh ba'ol chaviro, which means that when someone is going through a struggle, to make it your struggle. In other words, to feel for the person. Empathy, the real art of empathy, it also creates a culture of giving, a culture of connection. Not only empathy when it's a struggle, but actually to be really happy in someone's simcha. The idea of dancing at someone's wedding is not just, you know, they need a crowd to dance, so, you know, okay, I'll dance a bit. It's about trying to feel happy for the person. Nothing to do with me, it's not my family, it's not my relative, but to feel happy for them. That layer of connection. And I'm going to end off just with telling you a beautiful story I saw. It's not directly connected, but it's a beautiful story, a story of giving. How giving, we don't have to make a big deal out of giving, but sometimes giving brings happiness and is powerful, and it's about training ourselves to be a giver. So it's a story that also took place in Bardichev, funnily enough. Right. So there was a guy in Bardichev, there was a man who was struggling to make a parnasa. He just couldn't make, he was a bit of a shlemazel, a bit of a shlemazel. Everything he touched just didn't work, right? And his wife was giving him a rough time, his family were giving him a rough time. You know, you've got to do something with yourself. You've got to get up in the morning, look for a job, do something, work, bring in some livelihood. Okay. One day this guy arrives home and he says, I've got good news. He says to his wife and kids, good news. There's a very wealthy guy called Boruchovich in Bardichev, and he's hired me to represent his interests in Leipzig. He's going to pay me well, and the way you have to do it is like this. I'm going to go there, take care of his business dealings and things like that. And every Friday, you're supposed to show up at his office, and you have an envelope of money, a check, or whatever waiting for you. Sure, his wife thought it was amazing. But it's going to be, I'm going to be away for a while, like a year or two, and that's it. Very nice. On that Friday, she reports to Boruchovich's office, comes into the secretary, and says a story. And he says, I'm sorry, I know the list of employees. We don't have such a person listed here. So she says, no, you sure? My husband told me the whole thing. So he checks the records again, nothing. So she realizes she's been tricked by her own husband. So she starts to cry. As she starts to cry, Boruchovich hears the story from his office. And he comes in. He says, what's going on here? So she tells him the story. And Boruchovich, on the spot, without thinking, says to her, oh, I'm so sorry. I forgot to tell my secretary. Of course, 100%. And he tells him, put him down. He's representing my interests. I'll think you come every Friday and we'll be there for you. Okay. Goes every Friday. They're living pretty well. They have clothes to wear. They have food to eat. Comfortable. 2 years later, the husband comes back. He actually managed to find work abroad. He actually did manage to achieve some level of success. He's on his way back, but he knows when he comes into the door, is he going to get what they call in Yiddish a mishaberach? You know, he's going to get like, you know, and he's bracing himself for it. And he comes into the door and he says, hi, I'm home. And he looks around. Everything seems pretty good. Everyone's walking around with decent clothes. Everyone, there seems to be a fridge full of food or whatever it was with it. And he says, how did this work? So she probably did give him a bit of mishaberach, but then after she says to him, what do you mean? I went every Friday and picked up the check. So he runs to Boruchovich's office and he realizes what happened. It was all nonsense and Boruchovich had made the whole thing up. So he calculated how much he actually owes him. And he goes to the office. This is where the story goes. He calculated everything he owed him and he went to pay his debt. And he says, I'm really, really sorry. I was desperate. I had to get away. I'm sorry I roped you into this and I'm so grateful to you that you actually bought into the story, and I've come to repay the whole debt. So Boruchovich says to him, absolutely not. He says, I was really happy to support your family, and I will not sell that happiness for money. Right? Giving brings happiness. So what we need to realize, just in summation therefore, is this. To go back to the author's words. And the author's words is, if you want to change the world, he says, find someone to help you paddle. Find someone to share your life with. Make as many friends as possible and never forget that your success depends on others. Have a great week. Thank you.